There we go.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Nina.
My pleasure.
All right. Again, I apologize for that, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. All right. So here we go. Hello, everybody. My name is Sally Levin. Technically, I'm a rabbi, but I'm a layman as far as my day-to-day job. So I don't go by rabbi. I go by Sally. So we're going to stick with that, hopefully. This is my first time teaching this curriculum, so bear with me. I've just not familiar with the format as much if you guys are regular members of this class. Hopefully it'll be different, but I will get started. And at any point, if you like to stop me, feel free to do so. I don't mind going on a tangent if you guys are comfortable with it. If you prefer not, then let me know. So the goal of our booklet today is, the title is When Pain Spells Gain, which I think is a pretty straightforward idea that most of us have experienced and heard of. In order to accomplish something in life, we have to go through some kind of pain, some kind of constriction in order to come out of it on the other side in a better way. Otherwise, there is no growth. That is the theme of today's class. But first, let's go over a quick overview of the parsha of this week. And I believe it's on page one of your handouts. And are you guys seeing my screen?
The handout wasn't attached to the email.
Okay, so I just shared my screen. Are you able to see on the screen the Zoom as well as the PDF?
Yes, sir.
Okay, perfect. Okay, great. So if you don't have the actual handout, I believe the rabbi said it can be downloaded on Amazon through JLI. The JLI has an app, and you were able to download it, I believe. If you're not able to, then reach out to the rabbi.
Bigger.
I am going to try to do so. The only problem is I won't see you, so I don't mind that as much.
That's fine.
Seeing you, but I do want you to see this, so let me make it. Is that – let's see. Oh, wrong direction.
That's smaller.
Yeah, yeah, Harry. How about that?
That's perfect. Thank you.
Okay, great. Okay, so starting with the Parsha overview, so just the story of this week's Parsha as this week's Torah portion. Last week, we ended off with Yosef and his brothers passing away in Egypt. And this week, the Torah starts off with the story of the Jews in Egypt. Technically speaking, this is the only week where it's a full week of the Jews in exile in Egypt. The prior weeks in portions, we're talking about Jacob and his sons being in Egypt. So technically they were in exile, but not in the, they weren't enslaved yet. And in next week's Torah portion, we already start talking about the plagues, which at the time of the plagues, the Jews were already no longer enslaved in the sense that they were not being forced to work. They were not allowed to leave Egypt, but they were living in freedom in Egypt and already starting to gain some kind of recognition in society. They were trying to earn money, as we'll see throughout the class today. But this week's parsha starts off with that, with the story of the, it sort of reintroduces us to the 12 tribes, tells us about them, and that they were in Egypt together with their families, and the whole generation passed away, and the new pharaoh or the old pharaoh, depending on how you interpret the discussion in the Torah, where it says that the king died, then a new king came. Some say it was the same pharaoh. Some say it was a new pharaoh. But if it was the same pharaoh, he died in the sense that he purposely forgot about Joseph and his assistance in saving the Egyptian economy and nation from famine. And of course, he decides to enslave the Jewish people as famous, unfortunate, and infamous question of what do we do about the Jewish problem? He was the first to ask that question, and he had several ministers that assisted him in doing so, and they concluded that the best way would be to enslave them and ultimately to kill them off. He also instructed through his, after consulting with his astrologists, right? Not astronomers, right? Astrologists is the right one. I always confuse them. Astrologists are horoscope people, right? People that read the stars. So he had stargazers that told him that there is a Jewish redeemer that's going to be born, and he's going to suffer by water. He's going to die by water. And so the pharaoh ordered all Jewish babies initially to be thrown into the Nile. Some say he also ordered the male Egyptians to be thrown in the Nile, because it was not clear if the Jewish if the Redeemer would be Jewish or not. I saw interpretation that that was just so what they told the Jews. They told them also the Egyptian boys are being thrown into the Nile to sort of make it easier for them to steal the Jewish babies and throw them in the Nile. But as we know the story, two women that were the midwives of the Jewish people at the time, there's actually a discussion who those two women were. It's either Moses' mother and sister, or Moses' mother and sister-in-law, the wife of Aaron, named Elisheva, who's also mentioned in the Torah. Some say it was her, but these two women saved the Jewish nation, and they would told Pharaoh all these stories in order to get him to stop throwing the children in the Nile. I actually heard an interesting medrash that says that in the end, what Pharaoh actually did was he built a hospital which required all women to come give birth at that hospital, so to avoid them being able to hide their children. And then, of course, we know the story that the Yocheved actually remarries her husband and has a baby, who's Moses. She hides him from the Egyptians and puts him in the Nile in a basket, and he's found by the daughter of Pharaoh, Miriam. And Miriam saves him and brings him to the palace, and he's raised by Miriam and by the Pharaoh. Moses was raised in a in the highest of the high in the Egyptian society. And then, of course, Moses goes out as a young man to check out his brothers and see how they're doing. In the first day, he notices an Egyptian beating on a Jewish person. He kills the Egyptian, buries him in the sand. The next day, he comes out and he sees two Jews fighting, and he tells them off, and they threaten him, saying, "Are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian?" Moses heard this, realized that they saw what he did, and got concerned that they will report him to the authorities, which they actually did. And Moses runs away from Mitzrayim and ends up in Midian. Just a curious note, which some people don't realize, Moses supposedly was either 13 or 18 when he had this whole story with the Egyptian and killing the Egyptian. Moses is 80 when he comes back to Pharaoh. Where was he for 60 years? There are some say that he was in Cush, in what's some people think is today modern Ethiopia. And he was actually a king there for 40 years. Part of the, again, I'm going off a little here, but the story where Miriam speaks and gossips about Moses, about marrying a Cushite woman, some say what it's referring to is the fact that he married a Cushite woman in Cush, as part, because being a king in Cush required him to marry a local. And he either married her or refused to marry her. So supposedly the discussion was about that he has some, you know, skeletons in his closet, as it were. But supposedly he was there for a period of time and he had other travels. But he ends up in Midian, where he saves the daughters of Yisro, of Jethro, from other shepherds that wanted to stop them from gaining access to the well. And then he ends up marrying the daughter of Jethro, Zipporah. They have two children. And then God reveals himself to Moses at the burning bush and has the whole discussion with him and tells him to go save the Jews and tell them that it's time to take them out of Egypt. Moses returns to Egypt. And again, I'm not going through all the details. I added more than I should have already. But Moses ends up back in Egypt, goes to Pharaoh, tells him, "Let my people go." Pharaoh says no, doubles down on the enslavement and on the cruelty of the enslavement. And the parsha ends off with Moses crying out to God, "Why have you done evil to your people? Why have you caused them negative, bad?" Hari Isa is the word in the Torah, that why did you cause them such pain? Which is in itself a curious question. Why is Moses asking this question? God told him, as part of their discussion at the burning bush, that Pharaoh is not going to let the Jews out until God shows him his mighty hand. So what was Moses thinking, and why is he challenging God? I'll leave that on the table. If we have time at the end to come back to that, maybe we will. So that's the overview of the parsha. We're going to specifically focus on the name and idea of this parsha in general. That's our focus today in the class. Right? Like I said, the title again is When Pain Spells Gain, the Key to Unlocking Your Deepest Self. But that's a theme of this parsha. In this week's parsha, the name of the parsha is names. That's the name of the parsha. Like, who's on first? The names of the Jewish people's names, which in itself, as we see from Rashi, and we'll see soon, we'll bring some quotes, This connotes a positive message. The name and opening passages refer to three ideas of positivity in this parasha. One is that God loves us. That's why he's counting the Jewish people. Again, even though we've already mentioned the tribes' names at least three times in the Torah up until now, and the Torah repeats it because, as Rashi tells us, God wants to show how much he loves us, and as somebody who counts things or goes over what he has or she has will do over and over again, God is doing the same thing. So that's a positive thing, expressing God's love to us. Also, that our suffering was minimized the Torah mentions that all the Jews, all the brothers of Yosef died before the enslavement actually happened. And we know from the Torah telling us the last one to die of the brothers was Levi. He died at 137 years old, which is approximately 94 years after the Jews came to Egypt with Jacob and his sons. And so as long as one brother was alive, the enslavement did not start. And then the Jews left 210 years after Jacob arrived. So, right, minus 94. So the whole, amount of negative time, and I'm not minimizing, it was 100 and something years. It was difficult, but and the name or the initial passages in the Torah, this week's portion, tell us about this and emphasize the fact that God minimized the suffering to only when all the brothers died. So again, expressing God's love to us. And finally, it somehow, and as we'll see throughout the class, hopefully connotes the idea of the promise of redemption. The idea of the names actually tells us that this is about redemption, as we'll get to. The problem we have is that the Torah portion itself does not mostly discuss these subjects. The majority of our Torah portion discusses the suffering of the Jews and the fact that Pharaoh would not let them out. So there's a general rule that we have, and I say we have, meaning this is Lubavitcher Rebbe's insistence, that a name of a portion has to include all the themes of the portion. Meaning, if there's a name of a Torah portion, every single thing discussed in that portion somehow relates to the name. For example, a famous one is that the portion we read a few weeks ago, Chaye Sarah, or actually last week's Torah portion, Vayechi Yaakov, it's called Vayechi, and he lived, literally is the discussion of Yaakov's death. So it all has to mean somehow an idea of life. So here also, the theme of the Parsha, as far as the actual content, is a negative one, whereas the beginning and the name and the first few verses seem to connote positivity, so we have to reconcile that. Now we also have to address the idea that exile seems to be something we need to do. We have to go through. It starts from Abraham. Abraham went into exile. He left his going to the land of Israel was actually his exile because he was leaving his parents' home. Isaac was not really in exile, but he was had other issues. Jacob was definitely in exile. Joseph was in exile. The Jews were in exile in Egypt. And so this idea of exile seems to be a very important part of our existence and our growth. And we have to understand that. And why is that necessary? And then again, how does all tie together to the name of the parasha? We sort of have to relate everything together. So on our first page three of your handouts, there's a question there: which runner comes out ahead? I think you have that right. Is that what you have in front of you there? Okay. Is there something before that I'm missing? No.
It's overview.
There's what comes first, though. Oh, first comes the question. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So the question is simply the premise to the question is, if you have two people that are running somewhere and one person is training for speed and trying to get, the ideal conditions to get the fastest mile, and a second runner who's trying to run the hardest mile, most difficult terrain, and both practice and try hard. And then the question is, who, if they would race each other, who comes out ahead? Or in the case of these two, who do you think is better between the two?
The second one.
Because of?
because he's training under adverse conditions. The first one seems to be training for speed only, without regard to conditions. The second one, if you like, is tougher.
And okay, but if they were to race each other, I would assume that the person that trained for speed would win. So doesn't he, in a sense, have an advantage?
Maybe that's the way the smart money would bet. But I think the guy who's who trains as hard as he can will do better.
Right. So, okay. Anybody else have comments on that want to maybe disagree? Okay, I guess not. So I guess the answer is you're right and you're wrong, meaning it depends what we're measuring for. If we're measuring for speed, the first person who trained for speed will most probably win in a game of speed. If it's a game of endurance or difficult terrain, the second one will obviously win. And so it comes down to the question of what is the goal. Is the goal to run the fastest mile, or is the goal to have the most endurance? And so that's the question that faces us. And that's also the question that applies to us in this week's portion and the discussion of exile, is what is the purpose of the training? Exile is some kind of training. So it's a preparation for something. We know that Abraham had the choice. He was given the choice by God at the, what's called the covenant of the halves, I think, in English. Bris bin Absarim, where they split the animals and Abraham walked through with God. Anybody? Okay. Well, this was in a few portions back. There was this idea that that God made a covenant with Abraham that he will bless his children, and he gave him two options. He said, "Your children can either suffer in hell or suffer in exile. Which do you prefer?" And Abraham chose exile. I want to digress a moment from the subject matter here and give a sort of analogy of that, which I think is very pertinent. I heard a great explanation about the story of Adam and Eve, right? Starting from the beginning of history, from our perspective, Adam and Eve were God's creation. They were perfect human beings in all senses, and God gave them a challenge, which required them to refrain from eating from one tree for a period of approximately 3 hours. Had they not eaten from the tree after those 3 hours, the Messiah would have come. The world would be forever in bliss, and it would be the ultimate utopia. And so the question that I think is it begs to ask this question: how could Adam and Eve fail so miserably in this challenge? And so I think that and again, I heard this explanation, and I'm adding my own parts to it, is that I'm sure, or I'm assuming some of you saw the movie The Matrix. Anybody? Okay. Okay, so good. So in The Matrix, right in the beginning, the protagonist, I forgot his name, was offered two pills, a red pill or the blue pill. And the blue pill was a pill he would take and forget everything he just experienced and wake up the next morning and live blissfully. And if he took the red pill, he would actually know the truth. Adam and Eve were given the same option. Adam and Eve were given the option of either don't eat from the tree and you will never experience strife or pain or suffering, and you will live happily ever after with your children. Option two is you'll eat from the tree and you'll descend into an absolute hell. And at the end of it, it'll be so much greater. I think the analogy for that would be most of you seem, and no offense, to be middle or elderly, meaning you're not young. I can no longer say I'm young. I'm over 40 already, so I'm not a child anymore. I'm not yet a true adult, but I'm sort of in the middle there. But in my 20s, and hopefully you guys can remember, if I would present to you with an option, either I will give you a stipend for the rest of your life of whatever would be considered a comfortable salary at the time, whether it's $50,000 or $100,000 or whatever the number is, and for the rest of your life, you will receive a stipend every year. You'll never become be wealthier beyond that, but you'll never want for anything, and you'll never have to work a day of your life. You can focus all your energy in being a good person and in doing good things. That's option number one. Option number two is I'm going to work you like a dog. I'm going to beat you. I'm going to starve you. I'm going to make you suffer. I'm going to cause you absolute pain. But at the end of 30 years, I will give you infinite wealth, whatever that number is, trillions of dollars. And you become the most rich person in the world. What would you choose? Now, I've posed this question to people before. Elderly people, meaning people who have already worked in life, choose option one. And most young people in their 20s choose option two. Adam and Eve were young, right? They were just born. Now they were mature in their intellect, but they hadn't experienced life yet. And who chose to eat from the tree first? Who ate from the tree first? Eve, right? Why Eve? Eve is a mother. A mother wants the best for her children. You gave me an option, either simple life or my children can have the best and I have to suffer a little bit, I'll take it. And that's what she did. And so she recognized that it's worth dealing with pain in order to get the ultimate reward. So exile is a goal. It's a means to an end. It's not a punishment necessarily, but it's a way, sometimes the only way for us to accomplish some kind of goals. So in a sense, the runner that worked harder, as I think it was Paul who said that the second runner is the better one. In from that perspective, then that would be correct, because he's the one who suffered the most pain. Now, again, you can argue that it's also painful to train to run fast, but in a sense, there's something more raw about the second person that really accomplished something, and you run the fastest mile, but this guy really dealt with something and overcame something. So that's that's our introduction to our conversation. Yes, any questions, any comments? All right, this is easy for me. All right, so let's go move on to our next page, a surprising start. So, and as I mentioned earlier, and this is what we're getting here to, is that the Jewish people, mostly in Egypt, or at least in our discussion of the Torah, is a positive one. Even though we have a little bit about Joseph, and his sort of in interaction, it's a short-lived, it's one portion, and then it right away goes to Joseph going from the lowest level of being a slave and being in prison for 12 years to being the viceroy of Egypt and basically running the country. And then in our parsha, we start the exile, and only in next week's portion do we actually start dealing with the redemption itself, the actual redemption. So I know it's a short section, but if somebody doesn't mind reading the first text in English, maybe Charna, you want to start? I don't want to put anyone on the spot. If you're not comfortable, then don't read. Okay.
The bondage of our ancestors in Egypt ended on Rosh Hashanah.
Okay, so this is a quote from the Talmud that the on Rosh Hashanah of the year of the redemption, after the first two plagues or third plague, depending on who you ask, is when the Egyptians realized that they're dealing with a serious problem here, and they cannot and no longer enslave the Jews. And so for 6.5 months from Rosh Hashanah until the middle of Nisan, the Jewish people lived free in Egypt. Most of the plagues did not affect them. And I say most because there are some opinions that certain Jews were affected by the plagues in a negative way. But for that period of time, there was no suffering. But we'll see also that actually, even at the first plague, Jews started becoming rich. Howard, right? I say I remember. Oh, thank God. Howard, if you don't mind reading a text two in our handouts. Page five, everybody, in your handouts. And let me pull it up here on the screen as well.
Rabbi Avin, the Levite, son of the Rebbe, said, "The plague of blood brought great wealth to the Jews. How so? If an Egyptian and a Jew were born in a home with a barrel full of water, the water turned to blood in the ladle of the Egyptian, but remained pure water in the ladle of the Jew. If the Egyptian asked the Jew for some water from his or her ladle, the water turned to blood in the hands of the Egyptian. If the Egyptian suggested that they drink together from the same ladle, the Jew would drink water and the Egyptian would drink blood. The only way for an Egyptian to have water was to purchase it from a Jew at an exorbitant rate. Thus, the Jews grew wealthy.
Thank you. So this is a direct quote from the Medrash. The Medrash is our technically a first Jewish literature after the Tanakh, right? And I think there's a discussion here about it. But so the Medrash is a reliable source. So the Medrash tells us this story about the Jews becoming wealthy. So we see right in the beginning, meaning at the first plague, the plague of blood, the Jews already started, you know, the tides were shifting. The Egyptians suddenly are seeing the Jews as not a second-class race, but somebody that they actually have to reckon with. And so that's a major change. The next portion, meaning next week's portion and the week after, we're still discussing the Jews in Egypt, is already a positive note. It's only this week's portion that is a negative-only tone, in a sense, of the Jews being in exile. And so, again, our questions that we asked originally are in full force. Why is the name of the portion and the first verse of the portion referring to redemption? You know, what are you talking to us about redemption when it's time for when we're enslaved? So we're on moving on to page 6 of your handouts. If somebody on the Zoom meeting would like to read, that would be very nice. And feel free to jump in.
I'll read if you can put it up on the screen.
I'm sharing the screen. Do you still not see my shared screen?
Okay. This is as much of the screen as I have. These were the names of the children of Israel who entered Egypt with Jacob. Each came with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And Joseph was already in Egypt.
Okay, thank you very much. So as we mentioned earlier, the Torah enumerates all the names of the tribes. Now, seemingly, it would make sense if the second book of the Torah, the book of Numbers, was a sequel to the first book. And in many times in a sequel, the author needs to reintroduce the characters and tell us, you know, the names and history. But that's not the case here. The Torah is one continuum. At least the first four books are for sure. And also, this is the only thing that the Torah chooses to repeat for us. And so we know these names already. Why not just say, and the Jews were in Egypt, and then Joseph died and his whole generation, and then get into the story of Pharaoh. What's the purpose of these verses that we just read? This is the actual verses that the Torah portion starts with. These are names like, oh, I didn't know this. Of course I knew this. What was the point? So as we said, this connotes idea of love, right? And then as Rashi tells us in this verse, and if you go to page 7, if somebody somebody else from the Zoom would like to read, that would be great. Sure. Oh, of course. Yes. Hold on a second.
Well, it doesn't mention Dina. I mean, I know it says the tribes of Israel, but
so again, it doesn't make mention Jacob either. It doesn't mention the 70 names.
Yeah.
It does say Jacob and his household, but it only
all the siblings.
Yeah, but only the twelve. Well, it only mentions the 12 siblings. It does not mention anybody else who came down to Egypt. There were other members of the family that came down to Egypt. Their sons as well. They're not mentioned. There are other children. As far as it goes, Dina was not considered a tribe. The 12 tribes, and actually that the 12 tribes themselves also changed later, right? The initial 12 tribes are the ones mentioned here, but Joseph ends up being two tribes and Levi gets excluded from the tribes, right? Levi ends up not being one of the 12 tribes. One of the 12 camps in the desert, Levi is the center camp, but he's not really a camp. He doesn't have his own sigil, right? the whatever their sign, their flag. The sons of Joseph becomes two tribes, right? Menashe and Ephraim and Manasseh in English, I believe. Yes, so Dina was not mentioned there because, again, the Jewish people are considered to come out of these 12 men. It's interesting, again, there's not, we in general, in the Torah, and it's a whole other discussion, and I think there's a class on this there, the discussion about, is the Torah sexist, or is there something else beyond the idea of not mentioning? Because there are only three women mentioned in, actually only two women mentioned that one alluded to in the 70 souls that came down to Egypt. I don't believe that there were only 70 men that arrived in Egypt. I would assume that they had wives and they had daughters as well, but they're not mentioned. And why are they not mentioned? So that's a whole other discussion. There are three women that are mentioned. Dina is one. Serach, the daughter of Asher, is a second. And Yocheved is alluded to in the 70 because she was born in the right as they entered. Okay, so I'm sorry. Somebody seemed to have volunteered to read on page 7 the Rashi on this first verse of the Torah for this week's portion. Feel free to... No? Okay. Maybe not. All right.
Not on the screen.
It's, oh, I'm sorry. I keep trying to, there we go. Go ahead.
Okay, while I'm here, I'll read. Although God counted the 12 tribes by name when they were alive, he counted them again after their passing to let us know how precious we are to him.
Thank you. So as we see, the Torah is telling us right in the beginning of the portion how much God loves us and loves the Jewish people. So again, this is, you know, strengthens our question about why is this the beginning of the portion that specifically is dealing with the exile of the Jewish people. Oops. I am very bad today with the technology, which is inappropriate, but I'm sorry. Okay. So now, again, as we said, the idea, I mentioned this earlier, that the idea that Jacob, that the Jewish people were not enslaved until passing of Levi. So again, referring to expressing the love that God has to us and the fact that he was minimizing the suffering of exile. And then we have a third thing, which is the name. And we mentioned this earlier, but we didn't discuss the details. The idea that names somehow refer to the redemption. So if anybody else would like to take the next section here, these are the names of Israel. 8, yes.
These are the names of the children of Israel. The names were enumerated here to connote their future redemption. The name Reuben, which means to see, alludes to the passage, I saw the suffering of my nation. The name Simeon, which means to hear, alludes to the passage, and God heard their moans. The name Levi, which means attachment, alludes to the fact that God connected with their suffering at the burning bush. This fulfills the passage, I am with them in distress. The name Judah, which means to give thanks, alludes to the fact that the Jews gave thanks to God when he redeemed them.
Thank you. So although we only quoted here four of the names of the tribes, the Medrash, which we just read from, actually enumerates all 12 and discusses how each name of the 12 tribes refer to the redemption of the Jewish people. So in a way, by repeating the names here, the Medrash is specifically pointing out to us that God is sort of alluding to, or the Torah is alluding to, the redemption that's related to each one of these names. So we see again a third idea of redemption mentioned in the Torah portion, which brings us our general issue, is why is that the case? So the question, I guess, we can sort of answer that God was sort of giving a little bit of easement, not easement, but easing our pain by mentioning these ideas in the beginning of the portion. And we can somehow explain that and say, okay, well, because we're about to discuss exile, God is giving us a little bit of a reprieve. But that would explain the verses, but not the name of the portion. The name of the portion still remains a question for us, which is why is the name of the portion names, which alludes to all these things about God counting the Jewish people and about the amount of time we suffered for, and the fact that the names of the tribes of Lutheran Redemption, it's all in the name of the entire portion and all the details within that portion, which again begs the question, why? All right. So any questions about this? That was our first section. And so we're going to move on now to the next, which we're starting to answer the question. Any questions? No. Okay. In general, in Judaism, there's two periods, and it's not chronological periods. There's two types of existences that the Jewish people have experienced since the moment of our inception. And that is the what's called Zman HaBayis, the time of the house, literally referring to a time when the Jewish people had a tabernacle or an actual temple. And what's called Zman HaGolus, the time of exile, which includes the time in Egypt, the time between the first and second temple, parts of the second temple period, and of course the destruction of the second temple, all are considered to be part of exile. And the main distinction between these two periods are seeing God or only comprehending God. In the time of the Beis HaMikdash, in the times of the tabernacle, the Jews saw miracles openly. Meaning, if you went to the Mishkan, to the tabernacle, or to the temple, there would be actual miracles you were experiencing on a regular basis. You cannot deny the existence of God. Whereas in the times of exile, a God is an idea that we believe in, which we cannot prove and do not see. We can assign things that happened to God and say that was a miracle that happened. Somebody was saved. Somebody was healed. We won the lottery. Whatever it may be, we can assign that to God as a miracle. But it's not. It can also be blamed on coincidence and luck and so forth. So again, the distinction between what's called Zman HaBayis and Zman HaGolus is the time of the house, the time of revelation versus the time of not, is whether we see God or don't see God. And so we're going to bring a few verses to discuss this and break this down for us. So if anybody can read the next two sections, text 5A and 5B, just because 5A is very small. Anybody would like to read?
And they came to see, so did they come to be seen.
So the first one, let's stop on that for a second. This is referring to when the Jews are required to come to the Beis HaMikdash, to come to the Temple Mount. We're required to see and to be seen. The idea, again, being that we need to experience godliness in sight. Okay, and text 5b, please.
When the temple stood in Jerusalem, the divine presence was discernible in the world. It was palpable in the temple and need to move it up.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
There we go.
And from there, it spilled over into the rest of the world. By contrast, the psalmist wrote of the exile era, "We have not seen our signs because the divine presence is no longer discernible in the material world. There are too many concealments."
Thank you very much. So, and this is a quote from the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Shalom Dovber, the Rebbe Rashab. And he explains it very clearly that there's a distinction between seeing and hearing. One of the explanations, by the way, is again a side note about the Jewish people at the mountain. It says that they saw the sight, saw the sounds, right? There's a famous, right? They taught us kids that you saw the sounds and they heard the sights, which is a very, very funny miracle for God to make. I mean, it's just topsy-turvy for what purpose? But in a sense, one explanation is God was making what we typically heard, which is godliness, become seen. And what we usually saw, which is the world, which is real to us, we only heard about it, meaning we had to be convinced. At that moment, we became very much aware of spirituality and seeing the world as what it is, not an illusion, but not as real as the spiritual world. And so that goes on throughout the time of the Jewish people, both during the time of exile versus the time of redemption, or again, when the Beis HaMikdash is built, when the temple is there, when there's actual revelation of God. And of course, this affects our relationship with God. When I see God, I am very close to Him, and I when I know that what I do has an effect, it's much harder for me to not to do what I'm supposed to do versus when I'm told or I believe that what I do means something, it can become difficult and I can lose faith and just stop doing what I'm supposed to be doing. So there's a bunch of long sections here, but I'll read one and then maybe we can go back around in the circle to go. So I'm moving on to section 5C here to discuss, again, not only the difference in the revelation, but what that means to us practically. In the temple era, we had a very different relationship with God than today. At that time, we sensed God verily in our souls. We comprehended him thoroughly, felt his presence palpably, and grasped him intuitively. This primed us for an organic mind-heart relationship with God, and we formed a real love, closeness, and even attachment to him. Now, in exile, we can't perceive God. This is the meaning of the phrase, I am asleep in exile. Sleep is observed primarily in the eyes. The phrase, we are asleep in exile, refers to our eyes being closed. We cannot see God. At best, we have a murky understanding of God. Thus, our relationship with God is rooted in our effort to understand him. We are unable to see him. Right? So this is a quote from the Rebbe himself. This is also another quote from the Rebbe Rashab. There's another quote later from the Rebbe. And again, so we see this, that it affects how we behave and how we do. There's a, we're going to a quote here a moment, actually text from a contemporary rabbi, Rabbi Manus Friedman, some of you heard of and may have seen. And so we're actually going to quote him. I actually let him do the talking. So, Charna, would you do the honors and read this next section for us? Text 6a.
3,326 years ago, God asked us if we would marry him. We had an extraordinary wedding ceremony with great special effects. We were wowed. After the wedding, he said, I have a few things I'd like you to take care of for me. So, please, I'll be back. I'll be right back. He hasn't been heard from since. For more than 3,300 years, he has sent messages, postcards, you know, writing on the walls, but we haven't heard a word from him in all this time. Imagine when a couple gets married and the man says to his new wife, would you make me something to eat, please? I'll be right back. She begins preparing. The guy comes back 3,300 years later, walks into the house, up to the table, straight to his favorite chair, sits down and tastes the soup that is on the table. The soup is cold. What will his reaction be? If he's a wise man, he won't complain. Rather, he'll think it's a miracle that the house is still there, that his table and favorite chair are still there. He'll be delighted to see a bowl of soup at his place. The soup is cold? Well, yes, over 3,300 years, soup can get cold.
Thank you very much. And this is it's a great quote, and that's this idea that our relationship with God cools down. And it makes sense that she'll cool down because, you know, the soup gets cold over time. But we're still here, and we still are holding on to this life experience. And so how did we manage this, and why are we managing this is the question that we ask now. Meaning, okay, God took us out of Egypt. And as we quoted from Rabbi Manus, he made a huge display and put on a huge show for us throughout Egypt, and then the splitting of the sea, and then the revelation at Mount Sinai, and the whole experience in the 40 years in the desert was, you know, God giving us food and water and protecting us from the elements. But then, since then, it's been very shaky. And like I said before, even though we may see God in things that happen around us, it's not in our face. It can be denied. And so why is that? And why are we still holding on is another question. I actually, and we're going to read another actually section from Rabbi Manus, but I do want to point something out because I'm not sure when this booklet was prepared. But the idea of us being Jews because we're Jews, no matter what, is something that's been very much brought to home in the last few weeks with what has been going on. There's actually an article written by a very secular Israeli writer who for many years very much opposed the title of Jew He said, I'm an Israeli, I'm not a Jew. And after the 7th of October, he wrote a whole article saying, I am a Jew. And I think and from my conversations with friends of mine who are very secular, especially Israelis, something that's been brought home is that we're Jewish. We're not Israelis. We're not Americans. We're not Africans or Europeans. We're not secular or Orthodox, right wing or left wing or conservative or liberal or whatever title you want, label you want to give. We're only a Jew. That's all we are. That's all we should see ourselves as. And that's the only way, the way the world sees us at the end of the day. We are Jews, and that's it. And that connection that we have to God is the same. It just is. It's not dependent on anything. Yes, it can grow stale and cold over time, but it does not go away. It's always there. And unfortunately, we were reminded of it in a negative way. We can, and many times do, remind ourselves in a positive way. But this idea is going to be a little bit more colorfully explained by Rabbi Manus Friedman. Howard, if you'd like to read the next section, or if somebody else wants who hasn't read yet would like to read. On page 12, section 6b.
Ask the Jews sitting in the synagogue on Yom Kippur, fasting, do you believe in God? You cannot get a straight answer. It depends on what you mean by God. That if they're the philosophical type, otherwise they'll simply say, what am I, a rabbi? I don't know. So you ask what appears to be a logical question. Then why are you here? For some reason, this average Jew who doesn't believe in God and is not very religious will look at you like you're crazy and say, what do you mean, it's Yom Kippur? Let's analyze this for a moment. What is this Jew actually saying? You ask him if he believes in God, and he says no. Or when I was younger, I used to. Or when I get older, I'll start to. You don't believe in God? No, I don't. Are you religious? Furthest thing from it. So why are you here? Because it's Yom Kippur. What he's saying is this. Why am I here? Because God wants a Jew to be in synagogue on Yom Kippur. So where else should I be? So you say, but you don't believe in God.
Oh, okay. It keeps going there. No worries.
He says, so what? He doesn't understand your problem. He is saying, today is Yom Kippur, even if I don't have a calendar. This is a synagogue, even if I don't like it. I am a Jew, even if I am not religious. And God is God, and when I don't believe in him, so what's your problem? The same thing happens on Passover. Every Jew sits by a Seder. Ask the average Jew at a Seder, do you believe in God? Leave me alone. Are you religious? He chokes on the matzah laughing. So you're celebrating the Exodus from Egypt 3,300 years ago? History is not my subject. Then why are you here? Where should I be? It's Passover. That's what's so magnificent about the Jew.
Thank you. So this is a famous, the famous joke you asked the Christian coming out of church on Sunday, do you believe in God? So, of course. And you asked the Jew coming out of Yom Kippur, as Rabbi Manus just said very eloquently. It's not related to a belief, a worldview, a political leaning, or a moral understanding. It's a simple fact. I'm a Jew. I'm going to be in Shul Yom Kippur. So typically, this idea comes out most during Golos, meaning the idea that a Jew can be a non-believer. When you're during the times of the Temple, to be a non-believer, you had to mean it. You had to be a religious atheist, meaning you had to believe that there's nothing to believe in. You could not deny the fact that there's a God here revealing himself. The only way you can do so is to choose to very adamantly argue this. But in Golos, we have the ability to sort of be on these, in the Hebrew, the Chodesh Techatunot, to dance at two weddings at the same time, to both be a non-believer or be a skeptic and cynical and question everything, and at the same time show up in Shul. And there are many stories, and some of them funny and some of them not, about this idea of Jews being Jewish while not necessarily caring about the ideals. And when they're challenged with it, they didn't believe in anything, but yet they still did what they needed to do. It's funny, I actually heard a very famous atheist who you're familiar with, maybe Sam Harris, who was a very famous atheist. And I heard him once in an interview, and he said, "I am a Jew." Now, he said it in passing as part of a conversation, but I said it's very curious for an individual who adamantly believes that there is no God, and I think that it's a religion. He states, "I am a Jew." He doesn't say, "I descend from people that identify as Jews." He says, "I am a Jew." There's something, and again, he may have not meant anything by it. I think there's something deeper there, right? It's like the famous story that was in Germany, the Nazis were lining people up and shooting them into mass graves. And there was a German walking by, didn't understand what was going on. And he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "We're killing Jews." So he said, "I'm a Jew." So they put him in line and they shot him into the mass grave. This was a Jew that was very secular, had no relationship. All he knew was what he was a Jew. And at that moment, he would not say anything other than, "I am a Jew." His life ended. So we see that there's a strong connection that we have which cannot be affected by the fact that we don't see or don't believe or don't understand. We're starting to get a little short on time, so I'm going to try to read through some of these and then summarize everything so we don't... I was told that I have to adhere to the schedule. So we will adhere to the schedule, and we will not go over time. But unless you guys want to stay, I'm more than happy to stay on. But let's just sort of break down. So I'm going to read a few of the texts, and some I'm going to just explain out loud. So I want to read here from the previous Lubavitch Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, who lived through the Holocaust, and as follows. It is obvious we're on page 14, text 7. It is obvious that the Jewish soul is fortified during exile to withstand the fierce opposition it encounters. This is because our intrinsic relationship with God is more evident today than it was in the Temple era. Though our minds and hearts have a reduced capacity to perceive and feel God due to our sins, our hearts remain alert to God. It is easier to sense our intrinsic oneness with God today than it was in the Temple era. Today, every Jew can easily arouse their inherent love for God that transcends all logic without much effort. Ironically, the darkness of exile is the very reason for the emergence of our intrinsic oneness. When our intellectual relationship with God fades, it stops covering up our essence. The darkness of exile allows our inherent connection with God to emerge and expand to the deepest chambers of our hearts. This translates into an unshakable faith in God and a commitment to avoid sin and to embrace God through his commandments. Again, if you recognize God and you believe in God and you feel God, then you want to do what God wants. And this brings us to a very simple analysis, which is resistance training brings strength. We know this from the gym. We know this from almost anything. If you fight and suffer a little bit, you become better at something. If you play guitar and you initially your fingers are extremely in pain, but if you keep doing it over time, your fingers become extremely hard and not pain at all. So through pain, if you will, constriction and difficulty, we grow. This is the idea, and that's the relationship to what we're discussing here about exile allows us as a people, as a nation, to experience together this kind of experience. We've been through a lot in our 334 years of existence. We've been through a lot. I actually found on Reddit a list of over 400 specific incidents that are recorded in history, starting from the destruction of the Second Temple, where Jews were either murdered, exiled, or otherwise mistreated. Mostly the big stuff. I mean, not talking about the facts that we were most probably, in most places we were taxed, but in a lot of places we were expelled, murdered, sold as slaves. I mean, it's a scary list to look at, but yet we're still sitting here on a Wednesday night in Atlanta, Georgia, learning Torah. And I'm assuming that most people here come from different backgrounds and grew up in different ways and have different levels of observance. But we all identify as the same. We are Jews. And we're here. So why is that? And that's because of the resistance training that we experienced. They actually brought a quote here from betterhealth.vic.gov.au. So this is an Australian government site that tells us that resistance training, and on page 15, resistance training is based on the principle that muscles of the body will work to overcome a resistance force when they are required to do so. When you do resistance training repeatedly and consistently, your muscles become stronger. Well, if that's the case, we are the supermen of the world when it comes to dealing with being trampled upon. And specifically from there, we actually have a quote from the Torah on page 15. When you seek God, your God, from there you will find him, because you will seek him with all your heart and all your soul. I'm going to tell a story which is not in here, but I'll just give a great point. There was a person once that wanted to be successful and met a successful person and asked him, can you teach me how to be successful? And he said, sure, meet me at the beach tomorrow morning at 4 a.m. And so he does so, and assuming that he's going to be, start some regiment of training and running and et cetera. And they get to the beach, and the mentor tells the mentee, that's not the right word, right? It is mentee, to strip down and get into the water. Well, he does so, and the mentor follows him in and tells him, put your head in the water. He does so, and the mentor grabs his head and holds it underwater. And he is fighting for breath and swaying around. And finally, before he's about to pass out, the mentor pulls him up. And of course, the mentee, in this case, starts screaming at the mentor and cursing him out for causing him this pain and saying, I came here to learn how to be successful. You seem like a sadistic individual trying to kill me. And the mentor says very simply, and that's the entirety of his lesson, when you want to breathe, when you want to succeed as much as you just wanted to breathe, you will be successful. We need that pain. We need that restriction to be able to really show who we are. And that's our experience in exile. It's just when we're in exile is when we really experience. And so now to conclude all this, and I got 3 minutes, so I'll try to say it without rushing through it to give the idea. God did not abandon us in Egypt. God put us in Egypt because that was the way for us to end up at Mount Sinai and receive the Torah. Without the experience of the exile, we would not merit the receiving of the Torah. And as God tells Moses on page 16, we have the quote, when you bring the nation out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. And this mountain was known by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as well as to be the mountain, Mount Moriah, Mount Sinai, where they some say that's where the different things happened. They knew that this was going to happen, and they knew that the way to get here was through exile. And again, God had to bring us to the brink. He had to, and as we know from the Torah, that when did God send Moses? When the Jews cried out to him from their pain. Meaning God was waiting for the Jews to scream out. For those who want to stay, I'll tell you another story after this. And then we come into finally the idea of a name. A name is what we use to call our essence, but has nothing to do with who we are. Your name does not tell me anything about you, but when I call your name, your whole entirety is directs its attention to me. And so a name, in a way, is on the one hand, a disconnected feature of ourselves, and at the same time, actually ties into our absolute life force. The name of the Torah portion is names because the idea here is that the exile in this week's portion is not in a vacuum of just suffering and God then saves us from the suffering. No, it was intentfully, it was on purpose. God loves us. God wants us to come to somewhere and accomplish something and reach something. The only way we can do so is through the resistance training. And so in order to truly tap in to our true essence, we need to reach something much deeper. And that's what the name represents. It calls out to our true self, our true essence. As famously, the Alter Rebbe once asked his grandson, the Tzemach Tzedek, and said, who is Zayde? So he who's Zayde, right? Zayde, his grandfather. So he points to his beard. He says, that's Zayde's beard, but where's Zayde? And he points to his head. He says, that's Zayde's head, and so on. And finally, the child gives up and walks away. But a few moments later, he screams out, Zayde! And his grandfather turns to him and says, yes? He says, ah, that's Zayde. who turned around to me, who really came out, and there's no specific part of it. And so just to summarize our points here, counting the names represent the idea enumerating names, God loves us, our suffering was minimized, and a promise of redemption. In the times of the temple, the Jews saw God, but it kept them back from their true growth. In exile, we're able to not see God, but only through them can we actually approach God himself. It's not as authentic because it's marred by all our other distractions, but at the same time, it's a lot more real. And we remain connected to God in exile because God is our essence, and we cannot be disconnected from him. And that's the idea of the name. It's who we are. It doesn't define us. It just is who we are. And all this is, again, the purpose of all this is to ultimately merit the redemption. And our exile today is also to merit the redemption. I apologize. I am 2 minutes over. Thank you very much, everybody. And if you have any questions, by all means. But officially, the class is over. And I can say that I did not go over my time. So,
Great class.
Thank you. I do. If whoever wants to stay, I do want to tell you a very interesting story about which one was it? It was about the idea of exile. I can't remember now which story I wanted to tell. I was trying to focus on this. Okay, if I remember. Any questions, any comments, any issues with this message? Okay, well, then thank you very much, everybody who's joined us on Zoom. Have a great Shabbos and a great rest of your week, even though it's a day and a half. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.